content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled "Relearning the Language of the Land" by Ben Goldfarb. Humans perfected the art of wildlife tracking over millennia. Now researchers are rediscovering its exceptional worth. The 28th question of the hardest exam I'd taken since college was a smudged footprint pressed lightly into damp sand. The track possessed four teardrop-shaped toes and a vaguely trapezoidal heel pad. One toe, third from the left, jutted above the others, like a human's middle finger. I knelt closer, scanning for the telltale pinpricks of claws, and saw none. That suggested feline. Cats, unlike dogs, have retractable claws, and they tend to walk without the nails extended. In my notebook, I wrote, tentatively, bobcat. The hypothetical bobcat had been wandering a sandy floodplain in the California desert, where I found myself taking a wildlife tracking test one April afternoon. The evaluation was administered by Tracker Certification, the North American wing of Cyber Tracker Conservation, a South African nonprofit that has conducted tracking exams for 30 years. Around me, other students were engaged in their own examinations, peering at a bone-filled lump, great horned owl pellet, inspecting snipped willow stems, wood rat chew, contemplating stick-like prints at the creek's edge, thirsty scrub jay tracks. The vibe was library-like, studious and hushed, as we attempted to read the land's open book. We were participating in an art as ancient as hominoids ourselves. Tracking, by allowing humans to more effectively pursue game, drove us into hunting groups, grew our brains, compelled us to adopt language. In his 1995 book, The Demon-Haunted World, Carl Sagan posited that tracking shaped our evolution. Those with a scientific bent, those are able patiently to observe, acquire more food. They and their hereditary lines prosper, he wrote. Tracking helped to transform a small furtive ape into a global force. No longer does our survival depend upon our ability to stalk a springbok. Homo technologicus is more attuned to screens than to scats. The trails we follow are paved highways rather than paw prints. Even the field of wildlife biology has become reliant on technology. Scientists use satellite collars to monitor caribou from their desks. Drones hover over penguins in Antarctica. Motion-activated cameras snap photos of every creature that crosses their infrared beams. Today, a herpetologist can identify each frog, toad, and salamander in a creek by sifting through snippets of DNA in the merest vial of water. Crouching over skunk prints and jackrabbit pellets feels analog by contrast, even anachronistic. Yet, old-school tracking, a cheap, non-invasive method capable of providing astonishing quantities of data, is experiencing a revival. These days, biologists are examining tracks for many purposes, from forestalling wildlife conflicts to averting roadkill. In Wisconsin, trackers are following wolves to prevent them from running afoul of livestock and humans. In Washington state, they're observing faunal footprints returning to river valleys after dam removal. Biologists have trailed the antelope-like Soala through Southeast Asia's mountains in hopes of capturing and breeding it, and stalked lynx and wolverines across Montana to understand their abundance and distribution. Many tracking-based studies make use of data collected by volunteers who, with training, can follow animals as skillfully as academic scientists. It can be this very accessible, democratic way of gathering information, David Moskowitz, a naturalist, photographer, and expert tracker, told me. In the past two decades, tracker certification has conducted nearly 700 formal field evaluations, during which it accredited more than 2,300 individual students. They make up an eclectic array of people. The participants in my workshop included photographers, teachers, and hunters. There were biologists, yes, but also chemical engineers and real estate brokers who spent their weekends volunteering on mammal surveys. At the morning's outset, we'd gathered in a sandy wash and, squinting into the rising sun, explained our sundry motivations. One student said he longed to read the little letters that the world is writing you. Another declared that he didn't want to feel like a tourist in the natural world. You're all helping to revive real field skills and natural history skills across the planet in a way that is desperately needed. Casey McFarland, Tracker Certification's Abulian Executive Director, had declared. Then he released us to scrutinize, spore, to pore over prints, to track. For nearly the entirety of human existence, our species regularly performed feats of tracking from our modern vantage that resemble magic. So Elizabeth Marshall Thomas learned one day in the 1950s when she set out with three Juhuansi hunter-gatherers in Namibia's Kalahari Desert on the trail of a hyena. Thomas's parents, ethnographers and adventurers, had moved their family to the Kalahari when their daughter was 19, and the Juhuansi's practical brilliance instantly awed Thomas. The Juhuansi shot wildebeest, another game with poisoned arrowheads, then tailed their dying quarry for many miles. This required not only distinguishing tracks at the species level, but also recognizing individual animals. If a herd of kudus split up into several bands, the Juhuansi had to remain on the trail of the particular kudu they'd shot. It was a skill that must be seen to be appreciated, especially because none of the tracks are clear footprints, wrote Thomas in her 2006 book, The Old Way. Mostly they are dents in the sand, among many other scuff dents made by other kudus. Yet even Thomas couldn't believe how her companions followed the hyena across an expanse of bare rock. They were not simply following the line of travel, because out on the rock, the route of a hyena made a curve of about 100 degrees, she wrote. There were no footprints, no drops of blood, no bent grasses. Still, when the party reached the sand beyond the plateau, there resumed the hyena's tracks, exactly where the men expected. How they did it, I have no idea. North America's indigenous peoples, of course, shared an equal intimacy with tracks. It's culture for me. It's my religion and my people's history. Ahiga Snyder, a Diné, or Navajo, wildlife researcher who co-runs Pathways for Wildlife, a research group in California, told me. Tracks featured prominently in the Diné animal stories that Snyder's grandfather told him. Take black bear, whose front paws have straight, evenly sized toes that can sometimes make it hard to tell a right foot track from a left, because, per Diné legend, the bear woke up late on the day that the Great Spirit assigned each animal its tracks, and in his haste slipped his moccasins onto the wrong feet. Or consider deer, whose hooves form an arrow said to point toward prosperity, appropriate for such an important game animal. Understand tracks, Snyder said, and the whole world opens up differently. Scientists held tracking in high esteem well into the 20th century. In a 1936 paper titled Following Fox Trails, the biologist Adolf Murray described spending months shadowing red foxes in Michigan. Sifting through their droppings, Murray reported many rabbit bones and pieces of fur, the skull and the piece of a hide of a muskrat, the rear half of a fox squirrel, the posterior part of a skull, scapula, and femur of a lamb, part of an adult deer sternum, and some blue jay feathers. As technology improved, however, biologists adopted tools like satellite collars and motion-activated cameras, which allowed researchers to glean vital data across vast areas with less labor. Tracking fell out of favor. In some ways, tracking's revival began in the 1980s, when a South African physics student named Louis Liebenberg abandoned his studies, bought a land cruiser, and drove into the Kalahari Desert to commune with the San, a group of hunter-gatherers that includes the Jew Hoansi. Liebenberg had always loved to track. While serving in the military, he'd occasionally abandon his post to sketch animal footprints. Liebenberg spent years with the San, watching them track and nearly dying of heat stroke during an antelope hunt himself. Tracking was not antithetical to science, he concluded. It was science. Following animals inherently required observation and inference. What was pursuing a trail if not testing a hypothesis? Just as physicists deduce the existence of subatomic particles from the movements of visible matter, San hunters reconstructed the behaviors of invisible animals from tracks. It was conceivable, Liebenberg wrote, that the creative scientific imagination had its origin in the evolution of the art of tracking. The art, however, was at risk of disappearing. Many San neither wrote nor read. Meanwhile, ranch fences across the Kalahari had curtailed wildlife migrations and threatened hunter-gatherer lifeways. Around campfires in the early 1900s, Liebenberg and a San named !Nate began to discuss how to simultaneously preserve traditional knowledge and provide indigenous trackers a credential they could use to secure jobs as ecotourism guides and park rangers. In 1994, Liebenberg began conducting training workshops and accreditation tests for San trackers. He and others also developed an elaborate pictorial system, first operated on a Palm Pilot and later on smartphones, that allowed trackers to record and share their observations. They called the system, released in 1996, CyberTracker. Together, the CyberTracker software and Liebenberg's certification process proved their worth. Non-literate San co-authored peer-reviewed papers on topics such as black rhino behavior and found work defending animals from poachers. In 2002, hoping to expand his system to the United States, Liebenberg attended a wolf tracking workshop in Idaho, where he met Mark Elbroach, a young wildlife biologist who'd cut his teeth studying mountain lions in Wyoming. Elbroach spent portions of the next 3 years in the Kalahari, trailing animals from lions to porcupines with Liebenberg and his San colleagues, and between trips applying his newfound knowledge to black bear and cougar tracks at home near Santa Barbara. Elbroach eventually aced his exams in the Kalahari and Kruger National Park, and he and Liebenberg set out about importing CyberTracker's protocols to the United States. In 2004, they conducted an evaluation in the California desert, and the next year, Elbroach led one for staff at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. At first, they were confused and frustrated. What the heck are we looking at? Elbroach recalled. By midday, everyone was having the time of their lives. CyberTracker standards have been developed on zebras and African lions. It would be honed on mule deer and cougar. These days, Elbroach lives on the Olympic Peninsula, a wedge of temperate rainforest that juts from western Washington like a thumb. One autumn morning, I set off into the Olympic Woods with Elbroach and Kim Sager Fradkin, a wildlife program manager with the Lower Elwha Klallam tribe, to reconstruct a day in the life of a mountain lion. The cat was a 2-year-old male named Orion, whom scientists had outfitted with a satellite collar under the auspices of a long-term study called the Olympic Cougar Project. Mountain lions are generally peripatetic, but according to Orion's collar, he recently lingered in one area for more than a day, a hint that he'd made a kill and hunkered down to eat. Now Elbroach hoped to find Orion's meal and piece together the circumstances surrounding his feast. The three of us tramped through strands of alder and shafts of sunlight. Bobcat scrape, says Elbroach, who sported a gray-flecked beard and a t-shirt bearing his own detailed illustration of a cougar skull. He nodded to a barely perceptible patch where a cat had cleared the leaf litter and urinated to mark its territory. Moments later, we came upon another larger scrape. Notice the size difference? This is probably our boy. He picked up a broken fern frond, browned and curled at its edges. Following animals is all about color and pattern, he whispered. Beyond the scrape ran a faint swath of exposed ground, where Orion had hauled his prize. Whatever's at the end of the rainbow, this is where it starts. He turned to me. All right, now you're loose. Lead on. I blanched. Mark Elbroach asked me to trail a cougar. Was like Jimmy Page suggesting I play a few chords. They're almost always dragged downhill, he said. I stumbled down a steep slope, clambering over moss-garbed deadfall in pursuit of an apparent drag line. At the bottom, I paused to get my bearings. Nary a scrap to be seen. The ferns looked as fresh as though they had sprouted that morning. We're up here, Elbroach called from a ridge. I thought they dragged downhill, I complained. He smiled and shrugged. I rejoined Elbroach and Sager Fradkin as they traipsed along, pointing out what trackers call sign, or any animal trace besides a footprint. The exposed root where the carcass had rubbed off moss, the matted earth where Orion had curled up to digest. Plate-sized gobs of bear scat lay everywhere, and the Bruin's beds cratered the forest floor. Bears are big, lumbering beasts that leave a lot of sign, Sager Fradkin said. They're not delicate and neat like cougars are. She and Elbroach were looking for the cache, the trove where Orion had hidden his leftovers. Elbroach paused before an unassuming smudge of dirt, perhaps blood-stained, began to root with a stick. The odor of rotting meat wafted up. He plunged his hand into the soil with the flourish of a magician, revealing the ace of spades, held up a skull of a mountain beaver, an odd rodent unrelated to true beavers, whose burrows pockmarked the hillsides. A few inches deeper, and he unearthed an off-white fragment of zygomatic arch, a bone that had once resided in the head of a small deer. A narrative cohered. Orion had killed a fawn, lugged it here to consume and stash, and between helpings captured a passing mountain beaver, as though nabbing a bacon-wrapped scallop off an hors d'oeuvre tray. Before Orion could disinter his fawn, though, he'd been run off by a bear. There was no way to confirm the story's veracity, but it felt entirely plausible. The exercise wasn't only an enthralling party trick. It also had a profound value for the Olympic Cougar Project. While satellite collars could tell Elbroach and Sadger Fracken where cougars approached I-5 and other highways, thus guiding the location of future wildlife passages, only tracking could reveal what they ate. Figuring out how many deer and elk the peninsula's cougars killed, for example, could help tribes determine hunting quotas, thus keeping game on the landscape for felines and native people alike. Studying the dietary preferences of males like Orion, who often run afoul of humans while searching for territories, is especially vital. The naive ones don't really know where to go and how to avoid people, Sager Fradkin said. Instead, they occasionally develop the unfortunate habits of attacking goats, calves, and other livestock, and following small prey like raccoons into neighborhoods until they learn to hunt deer. Understanding the diets of these rambunctious cats may help prevent conflicts between the carnivores and people, and protect the species upon which dispersing cougars rely. We're redefining these animals to hopefully learn how to live with them, Elbroach said as we crouched in the duff, examining bone shards. There are still questions that can only be answered by digging in the dirt. After my experience trailing Orion, I resolved to try tracking myself. I bought one of Elbroach's guidebooks and began canvassing my home landscape in Colorado. I marveled at a twisted mink scat packed with a snake's tiny skeleton, at the pointillist artwork inscribed in aspen bark by a black bear's claws. Yet my callowness left me unfulfilled. Consulting Elbroach's books might lead me to believe that a paw print had been left by a red fox rather than a gray, but I couldn't be certain. I craved validation. That was how I ended up in California, scrutinizing bobcat prints in hopes of passing a tracking test. The exam's format was simple, its content challenging. Beforehand, our evaluators, McFarland, Tracker Certifications Executive Director, and Marcus Reinerson, a senior instructor at a wilderness school, had scoured the desert for animal tracks, scat, gnawed twigs, and other oddities. They planted an orange flag at each impression. Our charge was to figure out what was responsible for the various marks. Some questions were complex multi-parters that required us to identify not only what animal had given a track, but also its pace and the responsible foot, left front, right hind, and so on. Once we devised our answers, which in my case could charitably be described as semi-educated guesses. We whispered them or showed them in writing to clipboard-wielding assistants. From a distance, the desert appeared a barren expanse of rock and sand, but up close, it throbbed with life. We were asked to explain the provenance of a bone shard, a coyote's scapula, and a silk-lined hole, a tarantula's burrow, and a white crystalline splatter, wonderfully calcium from the urine of a desert cottontail. Most of all, we had to know tracks. A raven's inner toe was tucked close to its middle, whereas a jay's toes were clustered together. Two long paddle-shaped marks, punctuated by a pair of small circles, were the hind and front feet of a resting jackrabbit. Each time we finished answering a bunch of questions, we gathered to debrief. I'd been dreading this park, which promised to expose my ignorance, but I needn't have worried. The vibe was less oral examination and more Socratic dialogue. How do you tell a domestic dog's claws from a coyote's? Among other differences, dog leaves blunter marks, since their nails are clipped or filed down on pavement. How do we know this turd came from a toad? It's gleaming with insect exoskeletons. McFarlane and Reinerson, good-natured and non-judgmental, greeted even incorrect answers with an exclamation of fantastic. Wrongness was an opportunity to learn. This point was reinforced by what we were asked to identify, the source of chew marks on a prickly pear. I thought it was a mule deer, one student said. I'd guess bighorn sheep, which often eat cactus in the desert. Excellent, McFarlane enthused. Then he pointed out what was missing from the scene, the spines of the cactus. A deer or sheep would have nibbled the prickly pear's flesh around the needles, which then have fallen to the ground. Their absence suggested that some creature had carried them off. This, then, was the toothwork of a wood rat, which had borne away the spines to armor its nest. They're getting a food source, but they're also getting protective equipment, McFarlane said. Even a diminutive rodent wrote upon the earth. Sometimes, as we perused tracks and sign, I was appalled by my ignorance. How could I have confused the rabbit pellet for a squirrel's? Other times I felt insightful, as when I picked out the shuffle of a quail from a welter of scuffs. Most of all, I appreciate the rarity of this experience, to hunch for long and silent minutes over a scratch or dropping. I felt that I was back in an English classroom, slowly digesting and interpreting a complex text. This is the first alphabet that we as a human species had been able to read, Sarah Spaeth, an evaluation assistant, told me during a quiet moment. Spaeth, who is visiting from Western Washington, is at the vanguard of the tracking revolution. The director of conservation and strategic partnerships for the Jefferson Land Trust, Spaeth had begun tracking more than a decade earlier after she attended a workshop and gotten hooked. During one early evaluation, she correctly identified the pockmark produced by a male elk's urine stream. She found tracking to be invaluable in land conservation, since it helped her confirm that wildlife was indeed inhabiting and moving between the parcels that her organization protected. It's such an incredible tool, she said. She is hardly the only researcher to rediscover tracking's worth. For the past decade, McFarlane told me, Tracker Certification's goal has been to train and certify as many trackers as possible. Its recent growth has been exponential. In 2021, the group conducted 46 evaluations in North America. In 2023, it ran 92. Now the organization was preparing for its next phase, deploying trackers in the realms of wildlife research and conservation, and exposing academics and government agencies to tracking's validity. McFarland himself was leading that endeavor. He would soon spend 10 days trailing bears with biologists from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife in hopes of quantifying how many fawns the ursids were devouring. There are these cool areas where skilled trackers in combination with modern technology could produce some awesome results, he said. For tracking to truly influence wildlife biology, however, we'll have to overcome reputational challenges. Tracking, after all, is a methodology reliant upon human interpretation, and humans are fallible. One 2009 study in the Journal of Wildlife Management found that Texas biologists surveying otters frequently mistook raccoon, opossum, and even house cat tracks for otter prints. As the authors cautioned, issues with observer reliability are potentially widespread. Granted, technology itself isn't incontrovertible. In a study published in the Journal of Mammalogy in 2018, Elbroach found that tracking produces more reliable estimates of mountain lion kill rates than computer models based on satellite data. Yet concerns about tracking's accuracy still dog the scientists who employ it. On nearly every paper that I've submitted where I've used tracking, I've had the reviewer criticize the use of tracking and be like, that's not really good enough, Sage Raymond, a Canadian wildlife biologist, told me. Raymond is among a burgeoning class of scientists trying to take tracking mainstream. In 2021, she moved to Edmonton, Alberta, to study urban-adapted coyotes and realized that snowbound woods were rife with little coyote highways of paw prints and scat. Over 3 years, she followed more than 300 miles of coyote trails, up ridges and down ravines, through thickets and under bushes. I shredded some coats, she recalled. The canids' tracks often led Raymond to their dens, which she said are embedded in the anthropogenic matrix, in other words, near humans and our infrastructure. People have no idea that there's a coyote with a full-on den and 8 pups just 20 meters from their property line, Raymond said. Although coyotes tend to be shy, polite neighbors, they occasionally approach humans and pets and can attack when their pups are threatened, especially when they are habituated to human food, conflicts that Raymond's research could help alleviate. Edmonton's coyotes, Raymond has found, excavate their dens on hill slopes covered in thick brush. If a likely den site occurs near, say, a school, maybe just thin some of the vegetation, and that's probably enough to de-incentivize coyotes from having a den. Tracking wild creatures helps us coexist with them. Tanya Diamond, Ahiga Snyder's partner at the California-based research group Pathways for Wildlife, is likewise using tracking to smooth human-animal relations. Diamond and Snyder specialize in the field of habitat connectivity, figuring out how animals navigate landscapes so that environmental groups and agencies can protect those corridors. For Pathways for Wildlife, the first step is searching for deer, coyote, badger, and mountain lion sign. To determine faunal travel routes, they then install motion-activated cameras along those thoroughfares to observe animal behavior. In 2022, Diamond and Snyder found the tracks of migrating mule deer intersecting with Highway 395 near Lake Tahoe, setting up a camera and captured heartbreaking video of deer getting pulverized by a car. A tragedy, yes, but one that helped to convince the state to fund a wildlife overpass to usher the herd across the asphalt. Thanks to tracking, Diamond said, that deer's life is not in vain. So we're going to have to stop that article for today because we've run out of time, but we'll finish it next week. I hope you listen next time to hear the completion of that article. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. I hope you enjoyed it. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.